discuss what we call Kaluza-Klein theory, but basically it's the notion of having higher dimensional gravity, so having extra dimensions in gravity, yet our world seeming to be four-dimensional. Now, the logic, it's actually nearly a century ago that Kaluza and Klein first came up with this, but the logic is that from the perspective of gravity, in other words, the geometry that we're dealing with, things depend essentially just on our four space-time dimensions, but there's an extra small manifold, extra dimensions wrapped up on some very small scale. So from a geometrical perspective, our space-time doesn't really depend on these extra dimensions, but they're nonetheless there, and they leave a sort of imprint on our four-dimensional physics via sort of geometric invariance of this internal extra manifold. So things like the manifold could grow or shrink in size, and that would be an overall scalar field. So we'll go through in detail the simplest possible example of Kaluza-Klein theory, which was indeed the model that was put forward initially by Kaluza and then Klein. And that is where there's one extra dimension. So initially, these guys didn't quite do it the way that I'm going to present it to you, in that they just had the extra dimension being fixed. But from our perspective, we'll see that we should allow that extra dimension to vary, and that will give us some sort of additional effects in our gravitational sector in four dimensions. So, I've sort of shown you about solutions in higher dimensions. I've talked about extended solutions. But in those cases, what we were doing was something very specific. I was presenting certain solutions and, you know, looking for possibly black hole types of solutions. So it was a very kind of specific example of having more than four dimensions in gravity. But here, with this particular approach, we want to do something just a little bit more general. And the idea is that our extra dimensions are small. And kind of go along for the ride. In other words, no features of our geometry particularly depend on the extra dimensions, other than possibly some uniform shape, like if you had an internal two-sphere. That would be the only sense in which there would be a dependence on the geometry. So we're going to look at it in the context of one extra dimension, and I'm not quite sure why these guys thought about this, but what Kaluza did initially was say, well, suppose we have five-dimensional Einstein gravity, but we want to just live in four dimensions. How does that extra dimension project itself down onto our four-dimensional world? Thank you. So we take our five-dimensional metric, so our five-dimensional Einstein gravity is going to be course, the five-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert action. And we want to take our five-dimensional metric and write it in a way in which we have four-dimensional quantities. So we obviously are going to have a four-dimensional symmetric bilinear form, something that looks like a metric in four dimensions. We're going to have a G5-5. In this case, I've labeled my extra dimension as psi. And then we're going to have cross terms, G5 mu. So in this case, I've encoded these as this gauge field, suggestively labeled. So this is like G5 mu. But rather than just have G5 5, G5 mu, G mu nu, we kind of complete a square here. So you can see where that's going in terms of calculating curvature. But this is actually a particularly convenient way of encoding things because det of the five-dimensional metric is just e to the sigma times det of that four-dimensional g hat. So it's a particularly neat way of encoding things. And then because our geometry does not depend on this extra dimension, that tells us that d by d psi is a killing vector. So what the plan is we're going to do a calculation. We're going to find the Ricci, first Riemann, then Ricci tensor of this five-dimensional metric so that I've already told you what det G5 is and so that we can actually see what the five-dimensional Einstein action looks like in terms of, hopefully, the four-dimensional Einstein action, so the Ricci curvature of G hat, possibly some terms involving sigma, and suggestively some terms involving A, or derivatives of A. So as always with Cartan, we find ourselves an orthonormal basis so that when we calculate derivatives, exterior derivatives of our basis, we know that we immediately get the connection. So that's our orthonormal basis, omega A and omega psi. As I say, the handout, which at least should go on the wiki, does have all this in it. So feel free to kind of rely on seeing that. So what we need to do is we need to calculate our connection one forms. So we take our derivative, d of omega a. Well, all we see here is the orthonormal basis for g hat. So I'm just going to say, well, that's theta naught AB wedge omega B. So that's our normal connection one form. So the theta ABs, so our theta naught AB, sorry, not the theta ABs, our theta naught AB is just the connection of G hat. So when I take d of omega psi, I basically got a d of sigma wedge omega psi. So that's that first term, d sigma wedge omega psi. And then my second term is just d of e to the sigma dA. So I'm going to label sure I get my signs right. This second piece, because it's just dA, is F. So F is exactly what you would expect from Maxwell theory. That's just writing down F in all its different forms. So now you're beginning to see why Kaluza and Klein did this. There's this notion that this cross term in the metric is potentially going to give you something that looks like the electromagnetic gauge field. So now I need to peel off my connection one forms. And this is now our first example of seeing Cartan with off-diagonal pieces in the metric. So if I want to read off my cross, my 5 mu, or 5 psi a in this case terms, here I can see that I've got an obvious piece, which is d sigma. And then I've got that term, which is F. So, fine. Now I want to read off theta AB. And I would be tempted, just from looking at this, to say it's theta naught AB. But that's not quite true, because remember, d omega a, I'll put it in a different color, should be minus theta ab cross omega b minus theta a psi cross omega psi. So when I look at this second term, theta a psi cross omega psi, theta a psi is going to be plus or minus theta psi a. So obviously the first term doesn't give me anything because it's omega psi cross omega psi, but the second term would. So I have to cancel off the f omega b cross omega psi coming from this in my theta a b. So that means theta a b is not just theta naught a b, but also has an F term in it as well. So this is sort of, you know, it's not that much more complicated. It just means that, you know, in our sort of block diagonal metrics, we could read off the one forms straight away without having to think here. We just have to take one step, you know, of thought before going any further. So now, I have to calculate my curvature. So remember, I'm going to use Cartan's second structural equation. So this one's a little bit more involved algebraically. So I have to take d of that theta AB, and then I've got to take all of those cross terms. So the first bit's easy, d of theta naught. Then I've got to take d of the whole, for the rest of the expression. Okay, so I have e to the sigma FAB sigma comma c omega c cross omega psi. That's the first part of that. Then I differentiate the f. And finally, I differentiate omega psi. That's given by this term here. So the first term actually here, let's see, I've got a half e to the sigma FAB d omega psi. So the first term here is actually the same as this piece here. Let me just write it out. Right, so that's just having taken d of theta AB. Now I've got to take the first cross term, theta wedge theta. So these are the three pieces that come from that first cross term, because the last one would be omega psi wedge omega psi. And then finally, I've got to take theta A psi cross theta psi B. Now, to get theta A psi, I have to first lower that psi index. That gives me one minus sign. Then I have to swap the order of indices, which gives me a second minus sign, and then I raise the A index. So that's the final term. So as you see, that first, there's quite a bit to be done just in this first step. But now, having done that work, I can kind of start to group everything together, because here, if I draw a little squiggly line underneath here, I recognize my Cartan equation for the background G hat metric. So I can put those two pieces together and get the curvature 2 forms for G hat. Then when I look at what's left, I see a whole set of pieces which look like omega c cross omega psi. So that's this one here, This is also a mixed space-time psi piece, as is this. And there are going to be some from here. So let me try and group those together. Okay, so if I look at this one and this one, in fact, I see that all of them have got a half e to the sigma at some point, so let me just pull that out the front. This here and this here, these two terms, are both the same, so that's FAB, sigma comma C. So I've taken care of this term and this term. Then I look at the next one, which is FAB comma C. And I see that I've got FAB comma C, so that's that one. But then I've also got here, this one is minus FAC gamma C B. So I'm going to relabel that C as a D. So that just comes from the definition of the connection one forms. And the minus sign is because that was omega psi wedge theta. So I've got to swap it. So I've done this one. And then you can see that this one's also going to give me plus F dB gamma A D C. So these three pieces here are all going to come together into a covariant derivative. So going along the tally, I've taken care of this, 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 that, 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 and that. So now I just need to pick out the cross terms from the bottom. So here, I have an FAC, sigma comma B piece. That's from this wedge that. And then I need to take this and this term. So I've now taken that cross term. The first cross term here vanishes because it's omega psi cross omega psi. And so all I'm actually left with now is this second piece here. If I can close that bracket now. So that's the final cross term, and then this term here that's sort of hiding. Okay, so I had to kind of just stop and think and make sure I got all my cross terms, but it wasn't too bad. Now, just make sure there's a line there so you can see which bit goes with which. If I'm calculating the Einstein action, I don't really need to try and unravel this to get the Riemann tensor because all I need to find is Ricci. So when I'm finding Ricci, that means I'm finding sort of elements of the Riemann tensor that will contract to give me the Ricci scalar. Now, this term here, this bracket here, contributes to R A B C psi, and this is an orthonormal basis, remember. That does not contribute to the Ricci scalar. So I don't need to worry about it. All I need to know from this are A, B, C, D terms of Riemann and A psi, B psi terms in Riemann. Because when I find Ricci, I contract on first and third, so it obviously contributes to off-diagonal terms of Ricci, okay. But they're off-diagonal, so they're not going to contribute to the trace of Ricci. Okay. It's an orthonormal basis, so I only ever take diagonal pieces. So here, all I actually extract is the piece on the left-hand side of that line, which is contributing to the Riemann tensor. I'll just put little hats on one side just as a reminder that this is, again, your orthonormal basis. And so the completely space-time components of the Riemann tensor are the Riemann of that four-dimensional G hat plus FF terms. So terms that involve something that we want to interpret as a stress tensor. That's what we get for our four-dimensional Riemann. So now I need to complete the story by calculating my cross terms for the curvature 2 forms. So these are going to be a little easier because I've only got one theta wedge theta piece. Okay, so if I look at theta psi a, that the first term is a sigma comma a omega psi, so I take d of that. And then I have to take sigma comma a d of omega psi. So that's two pieces. Then I have to take d of the FAB, omega B piece. Should have started this at the top of a board. So I realize the way I've written it in my notes is slightly not the way I was about to do it here. So this term is taking the derivative of the omega b in e to the sigma FAB. Then I've also got derivatives of FAB and derivatives of sigma, so that's these two pieces sitting here. And then in psi wedge psi, I've got pieces that are sigma omega psi wedge F. I've also got a piece that is FF, which is this piece here. And so, you know, that's, and then another sigma F piece, which is that one there, right? So I've got a whole sort of string of pieces. I'm wondering about that one there. I'm thinking I should have done this in real time rather than copying it out. So if I extract what I need from this, so as before, I'm not really interested in terms that are psi ABC because they won't contribute to the Ricci scalar. So what I'm really interested in picking out here are the terms that have one space, one sort of four-dimensional index and one five. So that's this one here. Here I've got two space-time indices, so I don't mind, I don't really want that one. This one here, that's two space-time. This one here, and none of those. So that's, these are the only terms that I actually need to keep when I'm calculating my Ricci tensor and scalar. So you can see that this term combines with the first to give the covariant second derivative of sigma. And so what the extra dimensional, the cross term R5A, 5B gives us is derivatives of that sigma field. So now I want to pull these together to find out what my Ricci is. So the first bit is taking R psi psi.
Is the covariant derivative with respect to the four to G hat?
Yes. Yeah. So in essence, every time you're sort of seeing anything here, it's always, so the most of these free, all of these free indices are referring to the four-dimensional space. It's the connection, the metric connection of G hat, but of course it's written in the orthonormal basis. So the connection components are not the normal Christoffels in terms of derivatives of G. They are the connection components in the orthonormal basis. So at the moment, that's what they are. And so that gamma CAB are the connection components of G hat in this, where is it? In that orthonormal basis, they're the EA mu DX mu, right? So it's not, you know, the half G, GAB, G, you know, GBC, comma A. So so to get R psi psi, I simply take the trace of that expression. So that gives me a wave operator on sigma, the kinetic term for sigma, and an F squared piece. To get RAB, I simply take the trace also over, trace over A and C of that top expression. So I get the Ricci tensor of G hat. I also get cross terms. And I'm just looking and seeing. I think I'm missing some terms there. Where did I get? Oh, no, I know where they're from. It's one of these. It's Monday morning, isn't it? So the RAB and the FF terms come from tracing over the Riemann there. But of course, when I find RAB here, this is equal to RCA CB plus R psi A psi B. So I also pick up those derivatives there of sigma. So finally, I find my Ricci scalar. So it was a bit more work than doing these sort of block diagonal metrics that we've been doing up till now, but still not completely unrealistic. So we've taken almost general five-dimensional metric, and all we've assumed about the geometry is that we have a single killing vector, which we are interpreting as our extra dimension. We are then reducing all those five-dimensional degrees of freedom down to four dimensions. We would expect, naively, if we're going from five to four, to get something that looks like a four-dimensional graviton, you know, so that's our G hat there. We would see that we've got something that's telling us about the size of the internal dimension, so that's sort of a number. So we might expect a scalar, and indeed we see sigma there. And finally, we've got these cross terms, G5 mu, which are sort of like a vector from our four-dimensional perspective. And here we see that in our Ricci scalar, we have an F squared term. So this was really the input or the idea, the big idea of Kaluza and Klein, that our five-dimensional metric reduces to four-dimensional gravity with a Maxwell field. So if I go back to my gravitational action and ask what happens if I input this into my 5D action, then because psi is a killing vector, all it gives me, I can integrate over psi, and all it gives me is a quantity L. So here, L is the length or periodicity of that extra dimension. So if I now multiply through in my action, this last term is a total derivative, so I can just integrate it out, and all I'm left with is Einstein-Maxwell theory. So it's very Sorry, there should be an e to the sigma in there as well. It's quite compelling, this notion, and kind of cute, the fact that having an extra dimension gives us a gauge field from our four-dimensional perspective, and we get something that looks like the Einstein-Maxwell tensor. There's just one sort of slight wrinkle. Although we don't have a kinetic term explicitly in our Lagrangian for sigma, sigma is nonetheless present. It's present as a multiplying factor in front of our Ricci scalar and in front of F squared. So this is not the Einstein action. Now, initially when Kalutz and Klein were putting this theory forward, they sort of said, now suppose we fix our extra dimension, then everything now goes through as Einstein-Maxwell theory. But that's not actually consistent in the sense that we know that when we do our variational principle for the Einstein-Hilbert action, we pick up boundary terms, or rather delta r had total derivative terms. Now, previously, those just integrated up to boundary terms and didn't give anything in the bulk. Now, because of this e to the sigma prefactor, when we try to integrate by parts, we are going to pick up derivatives of sigma. So even though they're not explicitly there, they are implicitly there. So I hope that's enough to encode what I mean. So this is actually, there's a couple of interesting points to just sort of raise here. I've been explicit about keeping in G and writing L. So note that our four-dimensional Newton's constant is actually a combination of the five-dimensional Newton's constant and the size of the internal dimension. So it's not some absolute constant of nature. It's now something that's derived from the properties of the higher dimensional physics. And then the other thing I just want to do before finishing this action is talk a little bit about the presence of that sigma field. So here we see that gravity or gravitational action, which is e to the sigma r, has both scalar and tensor terms. So this is what we call a scalar-tensor theory of gravity. It's something that goes beyond Einstein gravity. And we can keep working with this metric G hat and having our gravitational action in this sort of explicitly scalar tensor form. But what people often do is change what they mean by the four-dimensional metric in order that the gravitational action looks like Einstein-Hilbert. So what does this mean? Well, if we want to have a root GR there, what that means is we're actually rescaling our metric. So we do this via what we call a conformal transformation. So we write our G hat as some factor, position-dependent factor, times G. So what this means is that lengths are rescaled, but angles are invariant. So that is indeed what defines a conformal transformation. A conformal transformation sort of squishes your lengths, it rescales lengths, but it doesn't change angles. So remember an angle, you know, cos theta is A dot B over mod A mod B. Well, that's the same sort of idea here. You're rescaling the length, but you're rescaling all lengths the same way, so it doesn't change the angles between things. So if we do this transformation, you can find your new gammas, your new Ricci, Riemann Ricci, in terms of the G hat, in terms of those of G, and derivatives of omega. And so you find that your Ricci scalar is a rescaled Ricci scalar and derivatives of omega. Is that a disgruntled face I see before me?
I thought G hat was the augmented.
So G hat, yeah, G hat is my metric over there. I'm rewriting G hat in terms of a new metric G.
So the new one is G.
The new one is G. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this conformal factor omega, right? I haven't told you yet what omega is because I'm going to have to figure out what I need omega to be. So I'm going to rewrite G hat as omega squared times G. That R hat, if you like, of G hat is R of G times this same rescaling. This box here is box with respect to G, not G hat. Left-hand side, hatted quantities. Right-hand side, unhatted quantities. So what I want to do is I want to choose an omega so that the e to the sigma vanishes. That's the strategy. And so if I'm rescaling my metric, that also changes that g. So my, if I look at this expression here, det of g hat is omega to the fourth det g. And so you see that det g hat r hat is omega squared, sorry, root g hat r hat is therefore, that's omega to the 8. I'm doing root det g. It's omega squared, isn't it? So root g hat r hat is then omega squared root g r. So that tells me what I want to take omega to be. So I input my omega of e to the minus sigma on 2. So you can see that the omega inverse box omega piece is giving me a box of sigma and a grad of sigma squared. And overall, root g hat r hat has an e to the minus sigma factor, which is going to cancel with the e to the sigma that I had in that action that I calculated. And finally, and you see now here I've got a kinetic term that's come back. What I'd really like that to do would be to look like a normal scalar kinetic term. So I'm going to rescale sigma by 1 on root 3, so this looks like a half d phi squared. So my gravitational part is now in its Einstein form. I've recovered a kinetic term for my scalar. And then if I look at finally at my Maxwell piece, I had e to the sigma beforehand. And I've still got it because my root g scales as omega to the fourth, whereas f squared has two g inverses in it. So that scales like omega to the minus four. So this last piece, F, is conformally invariant. So that's just one of these things about electromagnetism. In four dimensions, it's conformally invariant. So even though I've got my Einstein action now in a familiar form, I cannot get rid of this coupling between my scalar and electromagnetism. So it's not like I've magically solved the problem by doing this conformal transformation and made my theory genuinely Einstein-Maxwell theory. I still have this extra piece coupling the vector and the scalar together. So this is how we see that sigma, you know, isn't just a sort of normal scalar field. This really is something that's part of the gravitational sector. So just to sort of summarize, that's what, after everything that we've done, this is what we end up with. Right, so I've got a couple of minutes, so just... Okay, so when I was talking sometime last week about codimension 1 defect, I claimed that I could take what I called a Gaussian normal gauge, and I could just define a proper distance going away from that extra dimension, the codimension 1 defect. Here we've got no codimension 1 objects or brains, but you could still come back to me and say, well, hang on, why have you got that A mu term there? Didn't you claim last week that you could always choose a gauge in which you had no cross terms between the extra dimension and things parallel, okay? I mean, that would be a perfectly legitimate question to ask. So what I'm now going to just sort of show is that the reason that we can't gauge away that A mu is because we are taking our extra coordinate to have a finite range and to be periodic. Now, while we can obviously do transformations on A that don't change our physical curvature, if we do what we would call an electromagnetic gauge transformation on A, it wouldn't change our physical curvature. We can't necessarily gauge A away entirely. So... So let's think about what we're doing when we pick a finite range for psi and make it a periodic extra dimension. This is our identification. We're identifying psi with psi plus L at constant t. We make a little cylinder at constant t. If I do a Lorentz boost, this is my space-time diagram with the Lorentz boost, then here, if I ask what am I doing in new coordinates, this point here is identified with this point here, which is not at the same t primed. Here, this is t primed equals 0. And here, this is at t primed not equal to 0. So when I ask about what happens with my compactification or my periodic extra dimension, I now have to include both coordinates in that relation. So it's identifying the psi with psi plus gamma L at a different t. So the motion, if you like, this... the motion in that extra dimension, which is saying that we pick up a sort of non-trivial G0 psi, is telling us that we generate electric charge by moving in the extra dimension. And that's not something we can gauge away once we have identified our fifth direction. So we'll come back to this tomorrow when we look at black holes in Kaluza-Klein theory, and we'll see that these cross terms here, so whereas with the Kerr metric, our GT phi was rotation in, you know, of the black hole around an axis, here our GT5 is going to give us electric charge for our black hole. So that's what we'll come back to.